So when my teenage son or daughter comes up to me and asks me about their own sexuality, wants to have some answers, wants to discuss it, is really thinking in very important ways about decisions that they're going to make, I better have a lot more understanding under my belt than to just say to them, just don't do it.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKinsey Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKinsey Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In these weekly broadcasts of Christianity at Work, Jack and Christine will strive together in an extemporaneous dialogue to understand the practical issues, questions, and struggles of everyday life in the light of the truth of the gospel. Here now are Jack and Christine beginning their series on biblical sexual ethics.
Once again, our program will be on sexuality, and this is our fifth in our series. We've just finished biblical theory of sexuality, and we're going to move into a biblical sexual ethic. Jack, you're really trying to lay a foundation for people of a sexual ethic. Why are you going from this perspective?
I think I'm most interested, I think when we get to be older in life and we kind of intuitively know what's right and what's wrong, what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, this is perhaps less important and less essential. But I think we need to be equipped to guide our children. And that's primarily what I have in mind when I think through these things and analyze these things, is when I was a child trying to come to terms with growing up and growing into my adult sexuality and so on, what would have been useful to me, and even more importantly, what would I have found useful to my peers as I looked around me and saw them make the choices that they made, what might have been helpful to them? It seems to me that the culture out of which I came was really ill-equipped to teach us what is the foundation for what the Bible calls wrong when it comes to employing my sexuality. On the one hand, some really extreme and kind of almost hysterical statements would get made. Don't do that because... And they'd make up something to scare you into behaving sexually on the one hand, and it just wasn't true. Or they had nothing left to say other than, well, just don't do it. It's just wrong. Without any really kind of giving them any kind of context for understanding, well, why would that be wrong? There was a lyric in a song not too far back, a popular song that said, how can anything that feels so good be so wrong, or something like that, I think is the lyric. And we have to understand that that's what we're up against in training our children, is on the surface, it would seem that lyric is true. If something feels so good, and being in love, for example, feels so right and so noble, how could anything like that be wrong? We have to have a perspective to be able to answer, well, here's why it's wrong. Here's what's inappropriate about it.
So you're trying to really help parents, help their children, think through the whole area of sexuality. Not just tell them, don't do this or don't do that, but give them a way to think about it, to review it in their own minds, to think through it so that they can make wise decisions eventually themselves.
Right.
And so that parents have a platform from which to help their kids really understand the importance of their sexuality.
Right. It is also useful for adults who only have an intuitive grasp of this, because my intuition is ultimately not good enough when I'm really under serious pressure of temptation. I have to know what my life is about and what is good and what is right and why I want to embrace what's good and right at a time when I'm really under pressure. So
I need to have an argument for myself,
exactly, yeah,
that works,
yeah,
that I have thought through ahead of time. I think we mentioned that last week. We really do need to think about our sexuality and decisions we want to make before we're in the midst of a very difficult, tempting situation, and be able to have it be compelling enough that we can stand firm in a place that we will think is right and good.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's go.
Okay. I think the place to start, and this may seem a little bit abstract at first, and but I do think it's important to get a perspective on why the Bible has the ethical theory that it has, not just with respect to sexuality, but with respect to everything. You know, what is it in biblical terms that makes evil evil? Why are the things wrong that are in fact wrong? In modern day philosophy, and by modern I mean for the last two centuries, you've found people trying to construct a theory about why things are wrong that leaves God completely out of the picture. In the end, I just don't think you can do that. In the final analysis, really only a biblical view of reality can provide us with the foundation for understanding with any degree of accuracy and with any degree of real wisdom and understanding what's wrong and what's right. So we have to remember what the biblical worldview is. Specifically, reality is all of reality, all of my life, all of my experience, everything around me that makes up my environment is a creation of God. And God is a rational, intelligent, wise, powerful designer who has created the world, has created all of reality according to some particular and specific design that he had in mind. Now, there's several dimensions to that picture that are important, but that's the basic picture. The heart of what the Bible calls evil is ultimately any action or any attitude on my part that is hostile toward God and the reality he created. Where I reject it, where I rebel against it, where I deny it and refuse to be grateful for it and content with it. I just don't like what God has done, and I don't like the God who has done it. At heart, all evil, I think, comes down to that in the biblical picture of things.
So, Jack, let me see if I'm following you. You're saying that God designed the world, and any hostility that we have toward the design that he made is evil.
Right, because it's ultimately hostility toward him, the designer.
Can you give me an example?
Well, if we take sexuality, for example, many people in our culture would want to say, all right, what is sexuality? Sexuality is nothing more than just a physical desire to be met whenever I want to. That's the theory of sexuality that we saw in a prior session when we were looking at 1 Corinthians 6. Food is for the stomach is for food. So if I eat whenever I get hungry, why can't I have sex whenever I feel like having sex? One could adopt that view of sexuality, but the problem is that's not what God designed sexuality for. God gave it a particular role to play, a kind of function to play in human existence. But it's very easy for us in our perversion, and I don't use that word lightly, but it would be very easy for us in our perversion to say, God, I would prefer a universe where sexuality was just like eating and I could have sex with anybody I wanted anytime. Wouldn't that be a better universe? And basically, God, I hate you for making my sexuality be what it is. And if we act on that, then we try to deny that my sexuality is what God created it to be and go off and make it into something that it's not. And I live as if it's just this innocuous, innocent, casual, biological desire, nothing more, nothing less, having no more significance than that.
So the hostility that I see toward God's design is really threefold in what you said. One is an attitude of just being angry at God because he made it that way, could be one.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is to behave in a way that says, it doesn't matter, God, that you did it that way. I'm going to do it my way. So I actually have sex when I want to have sex and forget his design. Or the third one is I deny its importance. I say it doesn't really matter. And I guess all three of those are really bound together.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, denying reality, defying reality, and hating God himself, just not liking him for what he's done.
So that's
all that are... All those things are bound together and all are part of the same rebellion, the same hostility.
And you're saying that all of that is perverse.
Right.
So can you define perverse for just a minute? Because it is a strong term.
What I mean by it is a distortion or a bending of what is, an attempt to change and transform what is in fact true and real and intended by God. Anytime I do that, I am perverting God's reality or my own existence or whatever.
And isn't that how the wrath of God has really expressed itself toward men, that we have perverse thoughts, that we have perverse way of looking at the world and acting out?
You mean as in Romans 1 when he says he gave us over to our depraved mind and our degrading passions? Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that in our hostility, in our rebellion, we have tried to jump into the reality of our lives and say, I'm going to do a better job of creating my life than God did. And to a large extent, what God has done in this world is to say, okay, do it. You know, make that better life for yourself. But obviously, we're going to be thwarted and foiled because we're not creators. We don't have the power. We don't have the wisdom. We don't have the wherewithal to recreate ourselves.
But we really try and do that all the time.
Yeah, and we crash and burn.
We crash and burn eventually.
Yeah.
Sometimes not for a long time.
Yeah, that's an important point. We need to get to that. That eventually part is important.
Should we not get to that right now? Or?
Well, okay. Yeah, let's do that. One of the points I want to make about a biblical ethic is it's not a form of ethics that a philosopher would call a consequentialist view of ethics. Most modern philosophical ethics are consequentialist. And what that means is they're deciding the difference between what's right and what's wrong based on the outcome of my actions, based on the consequences that flow from my actions. If my action produces more good things than it does bad things, or if it produces the most good things of all the actions available to me, then it's good. And if the outcome are bad things, then it's bad.
So using sexuality as an example, I might say, well, if I have a consequentialist view, I might say, well, I had sex with this person and we really felt good about each other and our relationship is developing in a positive way, I would say, look, then it's a good thing.
Right.
If I had sex with somebody and it turned out bad, I'd say, look, it was a bad thing. So it really doesn't have a standard of an always standard. It's very dependent on what the consequences are to in whatever circumstance.
Precisely. And that's one of the huge mistakes that I saw when I was young, the generation that was training us, a huge mistake they were making is making consequentialist arguments. Don't have sex, you might get pregnant. Don't have sex, you might get a sexually transmitted disease. Don't have sex, you might spoil a good relationship. The problem is, my generation would have sex, they wouldn't get a disease, they wouldn't get pregnant, and it wouldn't spoil the relationship. It would feel really good, and they would feel really connected to one another. They turn and go, you don't know what you're talking about. That's not how this thing works.
Okay, so our parents were saying, don't have sex because there's going to be a bad consequence. What we experienced a lot of the time was we had sex and it didn't have a bad consequence as far as we could see.
Right.
Let's take a break. We'll come back to this.
The ministry of Mackenzie Study Center is founded on a passionate desire to confront the truth of the gospel. Over the years, Mackenzie has offered classes, seminars, tutorials, counseling, conferences, and more to interested individuals. The staff at Mackenzie also write and offer to you the free monthly newsletter, News and Views. You might want to check out the News and Views titled, Bible Study for What Ails Us by Dr. Jack Crabtree. Jack takes on the popular sentiment that says being a Christian is just about loving Jesus and not about believing the right doctrine. Jack argues that although knowing the right doctrine is not enough to secure one's salvation, turning away from the pursuit of truth will lead one down the path of false spirituality. He says, from a human perspective, the only way any of us is going to survive is by grounding ourselves in the truth. The best way we can become grounded in the truth is by becoming grounded in the teaching of the Bible. And the only way we can become grounded in the teaching of the Bible is by making its study a priority. Call Mackenzie Study Center and get your copy of Bible Study for What Ails Us. The phone number is 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801. Now, back to Jack and Christine.
What we're trying to do today is lay down a foundation for biblical sexual ethic. Jack, I don't know about other people, but I know for myself, I really have to work at following a philosophical or logical line of thinking. It's not easy for me, probably as it is for you, to think in this way. And my guess is that other people out there might think, boy, I just must be dumb. I'm not following this. But I don't think that's true. I don't think I'm dumb. Well, sometimes I am, but generally speaking, I'm not. And it's just a different way of thinking than I usually think. So I'd invite people, instead of checking out because it's a little bit different way of thinking, to try and stay with it and realize that lots of other people also struggle with thinking in this way. And it doesn't make us dumb. It just means we think in other ways.
And there's largely a jargon and a vocabulary that you need to learn. If I were better at this, I could translate it into more everyday language, but I'm not smart enough to do that. So
That's it. Yeah. You're not smart enough.
I think so.
We are.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a nice turnaround. Okay. Before the break, what we were saying is that lots of times people say that something is good or bad based on its consequence. If it has a good consequence, it's a good thing. If it has a bad consequence, it's a bad thing. And there's no standard that weaves throughout.
I'm sorry, there's no standard what?
That weaves throughout. It's not based on whether it's good or bad based on God's design. It's based on if it's a good consequence or a bad consequence.
Right, right. And that's a very modern way of looking at ethics. And whether we like it or not, we've been largely influenced by modern philosophy in that regard. It sort of plays into our selfishness and our self-centeredness as well. So it comes pretty naturally to us that, you know, we like the idea that I'm going to call good what brings good things into my life, and I'm going to call evil what brings bad things into my life, and that I'm the center of the universe after all, so why wouldn't I define good and evil that way? But that's not the way the Bible defines it. I mean, one of the ways to see that is to go back and read all those Psalms where the psalmist is complaining about how come the wicked are prospering, God. You know, here I am obeying you, and I'm righteous, and I'm suffering, and I'm being oppressed, and I'm losing out. They are prospering. They're getting rich. They're getting wealthy. They're having all kinds of pleasure in their life. They seem to be having a great time. Here I'm having a terrible time here on earth, and I'm supposed to be the good guy. I'm supposed to be the one that's obedient to you, God. What's up? What's going on here?
And the implication is you've really messed up, God. Because they're having good consequences for their unrighteous, bad behavior, and things aren't going well for me, and I'm doing it right.
Right, right. And the answer that inevitably gets given is that things are going well for them now. And there's that phrase that James picks up in his letter about they are like the rich are like grass that is here today, blooms today, and then the scorching east wind comes along and kills it dead. Again, we have to remember that the biblical ethics is in the context of a biblical view of reality. And the biblical view of reality is what you see is not what you get. What we have in this life around us is not the sum of my existence. It's not the entirety of my existence. That I was actually created for a whole eternal existence that goes beyond what's here before me now. I may in fact be called upon by God to be deprived of some of the good things of this world here and now in the short term, but I'm not living for the short term. I'm living for the long term. And in the long term, far better to go to the kingdom of God which will be an incredibly wonderful, fulfilling existence for all eternity, having been deprived for a short time now, than to eat my full now and then be starved in eternal condemnation for all of eternity. That's the biblical perspective. So it doesn't look at doing the right thing here and now as the way to get more out of this existence. That's not its perspective. The Bible understands very well that if you do the right thing here and now, you may very well have to get less out of this existence than you would otherwise. That's just the way it is.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if for us as we're living here and now, it really does, and I know this is not the right way to look at life or judge life, but it doesn't feel that way. It feels like this is what is, mm-hmm. because we're so much in it. And so to willingly say, I'm just going to live with deprivation, means it feels like forever I'm not going to have, because forever looks like the 80 years I'm going to be living here on Earth. So you're not talking about something that's easy, not easy at all, when we talk about the biblical sexual ethic.
Right. No, it can be excruciatingly difficult. It can be agonizing to make the choice to make my whole existence be about something that is so abstract and invisible and far away and out there, and make that the thing I'm living for. It can be very difficult when the pain is very present and very real to me now, and the possible fulfillment seems right on the doorstep.
Yeah, well, I think of a person coming into my office and, for example, saying, I'm 50. I haven't ever been married. I don't really have any sexual experience. I'm missing out on that. I'm just not going to do it anymore. I have this friend who I ski with. I really enjoy skiing with. We don't have any intent of getting married. But look, I am so lonely. I'm just going to have sex with this person because I don't think it's right that God would deprive me of that my whole life. Maybe he'll deprive me of getting married. I can't do anything about that. But at least I can have pleasure and a reduction of my loneliness from having a sexual relationship with somebody.
What we have to do in our life is to take someone like that and show them a blind person who's been blind from birth and say, God has given this person an existence where they have not ever had the joy of seeing, of vision, and they never are going to have the joy of vision. They're going to go their entire life without ever having seen the things that you have seen. Is that okay? Now, because it's not me, it's a lot easier for me to say, well, if that's what God has done, then that's what God has done. If that's the lot that God has given that person, then that's the lot that God has given that person. Are they deprived? Yes. There are some good things that they have not enjoyed, but it's not life itself. There's more to life, and one can have a truly rewarding life without that. If I can take that attitude towards something that I really can't do anything about, we need to be able to ultimately adopt the same attitude toward moral limitations. Moral limitations are just as fixed boundaries as physical limitations. If I can't righteously have sex, then I can't have sex. Just like a blind person can't see, I can't have sex if I can't do so righteously. Ideally, we will be the kind of people who see moral boundaries as impenetrable, that we will not cross them, we will not transgress them, we just won't go beyond them, in the same way that our physical limitations are so real and so fixed that it's unthinkable that I would ever go beyond them.
I hear myself saying this a lot in our program together, but that's a really big deal.
Yeah,
that's not something that's commonly understood at all. For me to see myself as having as fixed boundaries for morality as a person would if they're blind, to set that standard on myself is a very difficult thing.
Yeah,
and I think the reality is it may be true for many people that they'll look at a blind person and say that just wasn't fair. Why would a loving God make my brother or sister or father or uncle or friend blind? It just isn't right and isn't fair. And rebel against that reality, even though they can't change it. But the attitude of rebellion and hostility toward God is just as present there as acting out in a sexual way.
Exactly, yeah. That attitude is just as perverse and just as evil. as any sort of acted out perversion. That's right.
Because what we were saying is that hostility toward God isn't necessarily only in our behavior, but it's also in our attitude.
Right.
It can be just as hostile there.
So, for example, I could be married and be faithful and monogamous, faithful to my spouse, never have any affair. And I suppose I could even go so far as to not play with having an affair in my head, but be completely resentful of my life and my situation because of that. That's wrong. That's just as perverse as acting on it. And understand what I'm saying there. It's coming out of the same evil. It's not just as wrong in the sense that the consequences in my life are the same. That's not true. Not acting on my evil is always better than acting on my evil in terms of the consequences in this world. But in terms of the evil that's driving it, they're all of one piece. They're all the same thing.
Okay, so what you're saying is that when we're talking about our sexuality, we can be rebelling against God from our heart and it be just as bad as we rebel with our actions. It seems like our actions come out of a rebellious heart, but the rebellious heart is the foundation. It is the core of the problem.
Right, right.
And God sees our heart even if other people never do.
Right.
Even if I look totally righteous, if I have a monogamous relationship, if I, from all outward appearances, look like I am really in line with what God wants for me.
Yes, exactly. And the place to work to strengthen myself and equip myself to live a life of sexual righteousness is to look to my heart. Is to do the work of believing what I need to believe and know what I need to know and understand what I need to understand and want what I need to want. Get my heart right before God. And that's going to be the foundation out of which actual obedience can come.
How does one do that? How does one have a good heart?
Well, ultimately, and I think we've talked about this before, but ultimately I can't make it happen. Ultimately, it's a miracle. It's a supernatural creative act of God to take the heart of stone that's in me and replace it with a heart of flesh, to make a good heart out of an evil heart. Ultimately, God has to do it. But in life experience, the way that works itself out is by my seriously and soberly asking myself some hard questions and making some choices. What do I want my life to be about? What do I think is valuable? What do I think is important? And important enough and valuable enough to commit my life to making everything I do and choose be about that. Ultimately, I need to decide that my life is about preparing myself, equipping myself to be qualified for the eternal kingdom of God in the future, by embracing the values of that kingdom and making those my own.
And in this situation with sexuality, my heart needs to be looking at God's design and placing my attitude and my behavior in line with God's design for my sexuality.
Right.
We don't like to think of ourselves as fools or as being foolish. Although we might entertain the thought while jesting with our close friends or family, being called a fool doesn't sit well with our vulnerable self-images. The Bible, however, makes it abundantly clear that you and I are members in good standing of a class of beings characterized as foolish. That is the opening paragraph of Wes Hurd's News and Views article, What Kind of Fool Are You? In this article, Wes demonstrates how the Bible draws a line between two kinds of fools. Those who are foolish because they disbelieve the gospel, and those who are fools for Christ. To believe the good news of God's salvation for mankind is to believe in something that the world sees as foolish. Believing the gospel often means suffering. It means facing into one's own evil and guilt. It means seeing the death that Christ suffered is a death we all deserve. We might decide to turn from God and seek happiness and success in the world. In God's eyes, this would be true foolishness. So, who are you going to believe? Or more importantly, what kind of fool are you? You can find this article and more at the McKenzie Study Center website, or call and ask for the free copy, 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801.
A quick review of biblical ethics, then, is this. God has designed the world in a particular way. We, as His creatures, need to, in a sense, submit ourselves to what He has created. It is hostility on man's part if we decide to go against God's design. We need then to really understand what God's design is for sexuality, which is something you and I discussed the last four programs, and then work toward making our lives be in line with that design that God made for us.
Yeah, that's true, but I want to be real clear on where the emphasis lies in biblical ethics, because I think I did not understand it for years. There's an ancient Greek philosophy called Stoicism that basically took the position that the world out there is this rational, orderly thing, and as long as I find out what the design of that rational order is and live in harmony with that design, then my life will go well. And if I don't live in harmony with that design, then I'm going to crash and burn somehow. I'm going to bring pain into my life. That's very attractive to modern Christians. That basic understanding of biblical ethics is very attractive to them. But notice that the emphasis is on how do I relate to the design in the world? That's the most important thing is, am I living in harmony with the design or am I not? That's not the emphasis in biblical ethics, interestingly enough. If you notice, when they came to Jesus and said, what's the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus' response was, well, let me give you two, not one. They are, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself. That strikes us as odd because we're so accustomed to thinking along these other lines of good is what is good for me and what makes life work for me, and evil is what doesn't work for me and makes life go badly for me. The biblical ethic is ultimately rooted in what is my attitude toward God? How do I relate to Him? How do I think about Him? What do I do with Him? Am I hostile toward Him? Or am I a creature who, with gratitude and submission and what Jesus calls love, look upon God and go, wow, what a glorious person God is? That's at the heart of everything that we do. It's a question of, am I acting in a way that is rooted in my love for God, or am I acting in a way that's rooted in my rebellion against and hostility and antagonism toward God? And that's really at the heart of what the biblical ethic is all about. So part of the biblical ethic is a recognition that I can't very well claim to love God when I don't appreciate what He did in the world. When I want to remake it and recreate what He did in the world, I'm really basically saying, you made junk, God. You're a really lousy designer, and I could do a better job. And I think I will. I'm going to go about changing my life. But what's wrong about that is not that I'm violating the cosmos primarily. What's wrong about that is I'm violating God. I'm displaying an incredible disregard and disrespect for the Creator. And that's at the heart of what is evil. In practical terms, what's important about that comes down to the same point we made earlier with respect to consequentialism. What at the heart of that, a kind of Stoic view has this fairly rigorous, rigid view about if you live in harmony with the universe, life will go well. If you don't live in harmony with the universe, life will not go so well. Years ago, I attended some classes that were by Bill Gothard called Basic Youth Conflicts. And unless I terribly misunderstand what's going on there, it seems to me that the view of ethics that Bill Gothard has is this sort of rigid Stoic kind of view that do you want your life to go well? The way to make your life go well is to live by these what he might call spiritual principles. Live by the principles upon which life is built. And if you live in harmony with those principles, life will go well. If you don't live in harmony with those principles, life will not go well. Well, the problem is there's all kinds of ways that we can live in harmony with the principles that are true, and life still won't go well. So,
life won't go well in the sense that it doesn't feel good to me necessarily.
Exactly.
I'm not getting all I want. It may go well in terms of if I'm pursuing what I think is right, if I have an attitude of trying to love God and understand Him and understand His design, I might still be very deprived of some of what I want. I might still be very lonely. I might never have a sexual relationship that's anywhere near good, or maybe not at all. But I may indeed be closer to understanding who God is and having a relationship with Him that is very substantial in my life.
Right, right. Obedience will undoubtedly lead to some kind of an intuitive sense of well-being. All is well between me and God. And I don't deny that for a second. I think that's very true. But sometimes that's all I've got. Everything else around me is falling apart and crumbling in chaos. And there's no guarantee that life is going to give me anything other than that.
And, you know, Jack, I may not also have that if I really believe, and if the teaching from my biblical teaching is that if I do things right, then I'm going to feel good. If I obey the owner's manual, if I live according to the rules as I see them, then things are going to come out right. Somehow I think God has either left me or abandoned me. In my counseling experience, I see many, many people who are just so angry at God because that's exactly where they're coming from. Look, I'm doing it all right, and God isn't following through. Where in the world is He?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't have a peace of mind, and I'm lonely, and I don't have a sexual relationship, and everything in my life seems to be falling apart.
Yeah, and part of that, it may not be the entirety of what's going on, but part of that may be that they're under this misconception that God has promised something that He has not promised. And that's why it's important to realize in the end what God is calling upon me to do is to rightly relate to Him. Right? What do I need to do to be the creature before my Creator that I really ought to be, that is really right to be? From there, the only thing that's guaranteed is my eventual and eternal well-being. That's what is promised for a creature who is rightly related to God. In the meantime, here and now in this earth, it really depends on what story God wants to tell through my life, what my life is going to be about and what's going to happen. And again, that's a good way to think about it, I think. God has in mind telling a certain story through my life. The heart of rebellion is saying, but God, I don't want to be that character. I don't want to have that role. I don't want you to tell that story through my life. Let me make a better suggestion. I want to tell this other story. I want my life to involve sexual experience rather than celibacy all my life, God. And I will not accept it if that's the way you're going to tell the story through my life. Well, where is that coming from except a kind of hostile opposition to God being God and being the one who writes the script for my life?
So you're saying we need to really be willing to accept the script that God writes for my life. And we only can do that really out of an understanding of who God is.
That's right. If I don't trust that He's good, if I ultimately don't know that He's good and has my ultimate best interest in mind, it's going to be very difficult to trust Him.
Extremely. Okay, let's go on. To take the next step in our understanding of biblical ethic of sexuality.
Well, I think from this then I can come up with four different categories for what the Bible calls wrong. That remembering that at the root, everything that the Bible says is wrong is ultimately related to is it or is it not an act of hostility toward God. There's four different ways, I think, that we can show this hostility. One is to show hostility to God himself. And what I mean by that is hostility toward his character or his values. And it's difficult to separate characters from values. But God is a God of love. If I don't so value who God is that I want to emulate that character in my own life, then ultimately I'm rejecting God. I'm rejecting who God is. So notice in that passage I mentioned earlier where Jesus is asked, what's the great commandment? He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And another one, like unto the first, he says, is love your neighbor as yourself. So he immediately goes from basically what we need to do is love God, but primarily the way in which one will know that they love God is that they really, really honor who God is enough to want to emulate his character in relationship to their fellow creatures. Since God is primarily a God of love, then we will be primarily people of love, creatures who manifest love. If we can take love lightly, if we can only love when it's convenient, or when it's easy, or when it's somehow in my best interest to love, then we don't really honor it as a character trait, as a quality of a person. And therefore, we don't really respect God, because that's what he's all about.
You're saying our hostility toward God shows itself in our lack of love.
Right.
But a question people might have is, oh no, I'm lost then, because I don't love a lot of the time. I mean, I see myself, for example, with my kids this weekend. I got really angry at two of my children and just did not act in a loving way toward them. But I think the answer to this question is not do we at a point in time not act loving, but do we want that in our life? And I would say for sure I want that in my life. I don't want to just lazily sit back and not care that I wasn't loving to them. That it matters to me a lot that I wasn't. And so what I do when I look back at what I did is go down and actually last night I went down to both my kids' bedrooms and sat with them and said, you know what? I really feel bad about the way that I related to you. I hurt you. And, you know, I am really muddling through this life in a way that's really unfortunate sometimes and really hurtful to you. But I feel badly about that. And I want to love you. And I hope that over time I'm going to be a better and better mom. But even though I want love, it just doesn't come out that way a lot, Jack.
Right, right. Well, in some future series, we'll probably talk about this at length and in depth, but to give a quick version, what you're talking about is a distinction between what we are by nature, and what we are by nature as sinners is we're just intrinsically hostile toward God, and therefore love does not come naturally to us. Love is easily disregarded by us. We will abandon love in a second if it's inconvenient or doesn't feel right to us. And that's just natural to us. That's as natural as breathing. To be unloving is as natural as breathing to us. And that's not going to change in this lifetime. That's what it means to be a sinner, to be a broken, depraved person, is to be someone who doesn't spontaneously and naturally love other people. But among all of us broken, depraved sinners, there are two kinds of people, what the Bible calls the children of God and the children of the devil. The children of God, even though they are broken and even though they are terribly unloving at times, they have this heart disposition in them that looks at their own brokenness and their own depravity and weeps. That's in effect what you were doing when you went down to your children. And with an incredible kind of humility that many people long to have seen in their parents and never saw it, with an incredible kind of humility, we're willing to say to them, I really blew it very badly. What I did was wrong. What I did was shameful. What I did was despicable. Will you forgive me? Why did you say that? Because your heart is committed to higher things. Your heart is committed to higher ideals. your imagination has been captured by the wonder and the beauty of love, and you want your life to be all about that. Even though it doesn't come naturally to be that, it's very genuine and authentic as a value that your heart has embraced, and that's what makes you distinctive as a child of God. There are millions of people in this world who do not have that heart commitment. Not only are they not loving, but they really have no desire or any serious intention to become loving people in a way that will cost them, in a way that will that will allow them to choose love when it's inconvenient and when it's not fun and when it's not easy. They think you're crazy to even make that kind of commitment. Well, that's a whole different kind of person. That's what the Bible calls the child of the devil.
You're right, Jack. It really is a cost to embrace love. It isn't something that is just words, but if we really do embrace it, it ultimately does have a cost. I struggled with not wanting to see how I was wrong in the situation with my children, because I wanted to justify my own attitude by only seeing how rotten theirs was. And that would be easy. I think we could get 100 people out here and probably 99 would say, yep, they had a really bad attitude, and maybe even support me. But the reality is I was wrong also. And I had to struggle with myself to see it, to see how it worked itself out, to look at myself and know that I had to have been part of this, and to really look at that. It's painful for me. There's a feeling that I have when I'm wrong, and I know that I'm really wrong, that almost feels like I'm going to disintegrate. It feels like it's worse than dying. It feels like I'm going to become invisible and just disappear. And on top of that, also be really dismissed if I show in any way that I'm wrong. So I'm really working against that really deep psychological fear inside of me. And I'm working against my own pride. I don't want to be humbled. And maybe those two just really, really go together. So it is very much a work for us to love and to work against our natural psychological limitations and our sinfulness.
Yeah.
So, Jack, let's go back to our outline here, our thinking about biblical sexual ethics. And what you were saying is that there's four different ways or five different ways that you were thinking about how we as people act in hostility toward God. One of those ways is we don't really understand God's character, nor do we care to make our lives in line with his character.
Even more importantly, we rebel against his character. We hate it. We're hostile toward it.
We say no to it.
Yeah.
He's a loving God, and ultimately we say, I don't care. In this situation with my kids, that might show itself in saying, hey, my kids were wrong. I don't care. They can just live with it. Forget it.
Right.
And not even worry about or look at the lack of love in my own life.
Right.
Next time we meet, we need to look at the other ways that we act in hostility toward God.
Okay.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, McKenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant: a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The McKenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited, and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at McKenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter, News and Views, are also available. Information about how you can find out more about McKenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
Today we looked at a biblical sexual ethic, at least in part. We started it. And I ask you, why is it that we're even bothering to lay this kind of a foundation? In some ways it sounds so very heady. But I really appreciated your answer to that, Jack. What you said was, when I'm in a situation as an adult that's tempting to me and maybe extremely tempting to me, I need to have a foundation, an understanding of why I'm making the decisions that I am. Be able to think that through and have it be bigger and more weighty than, well, just because God thinks it's wrong. The same is true for my children. When they're coming up against decisions about their own sexuality and how they act that out, they need to be able to have some way of thinking about what kind of decision they're making. It's got to go far beyond, well, Mom or Dad told me not to do this. So that's what we were getting at today.
You know, some people may object that they're really the obedient thing to do, the mature thing to do is if God says it's wrong, then I don't do it. That kind of just blind obedience is a really, really good biblical virtue. I don't think that's right. What God wants from us is for our wisdom to be personal ownership of the things that God owns, that His character and His values that He personally embraces and personally is, would become mine as well. A kind of blind obedience, as noble as that might be in certain kinds of contexts in relationship to God, because I do need to recognize if God just tells me to do something, He's got a much bigger perspective than I do. I don't need to understand in order to obey God's voice. That's true. That's certainly right. But typically, He's not asking me to obey because He wants me to obey, like Abraham sacrificing Isaac. He wants me to obey because He wants my own heart to embrace the values that obedience reflects. He wants me to like what He likes. He wants me to like Him and everything about Him, and so own that and make that my own that I, in a sense, begin to reflect the very character of God Himself. Anything short of that is not really the kind of obedience that the Bible is really asking of us.
But it is out of that kind of understanding that I do become an obedient person.
Yes.
Wanting to pursue what's right and what's good.
Yeah.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.